You're with Clement Maniatella. 702.
Advocate Shamila Batohi, thank you so much for coming to studio. You've no idea how long I've been waiting for this moment.
I didn't know that.
So I'm glad you've made time. I know you're a busy person. So I appreciate you making time to come and engage with us here on 702. How are you doing?
No, thank you. Thank you. I didn't realize you were trying for a long time. I would have been more than happy to come at, you know, at an earlier stage.
Yeah, no worries.
I'm really happy to be here.
Yes, thank you so much for being here. So I just want us to start off by reflecting over the last 5 years first, and then we'll get into some of the specific issues. How different is the NPA now compared to 5 years ago?
It is significantly different. And I think the key issue is that impunity is no longer a given, as opposed to in the past. But delving a bit more into it, you know, having been 5 years, I myself have reflected in terms of, you know, how far have we come as the NPA in the past 5 years? And let me say, there's two aspects to it. If you look at the NPA as a constitutional institution, critical for the democracy in South Africa, that was hollowed out in state capture. And we know the importance of strong institutions in any democracy. And so we spent a lot of the 5 years really trying to build a strong institution for the people of South Africa. And before I go further on that, we say 5 years, but to understand that the NDPP, I took office in 2019 of February, and for 18 months after that, until 2020, June, the only thing that changed insofar as the top leadership in the NPA was the national director. The deputies, two new deputy national directors were appointed in June of 2020. And the third one, and then we were actually in the middle of COVID, and the third one took office in March of 2021. And that was when COVID had just, you know, so it was only in March 2021 that we had a full, solid, new leadership, top leadership in the NPA out of COVID. And that is 3 years away, ago. And so we have been working really hard to build a strong, solid institution that will really serve only the people of this country. And a lot of work has gone into that. And so when I reflect on the time in office, I can say that in terms of building an entity that can serve the people, we have come a long way. And in this regard, when I took office in 2019, I committed in my first address publicly to deal with the following issues. And one was to address the leadership crisis in the NPA. We've done that. The second was to really look at a review of certain high-profile cases that in the state capture years, people were being prosecuted for the wrong reasons or shielded for the wrong reasons. That had been done. Reviewing of the NPA structure. We've done a lot of work in this regard. Sufficient budget. Looking at getting sufficient budget. We can talk more about this, but a lot of work's gone into that. Expanding partnerships. Stakeholder management. Strengthening the morale. The morale of the staff was devastating. You know, people were traumatized during straight capture. And so dealing with those issues was a big part of building a strong institution.
Yeah.
And we've come a long way in that regard. Mm-hmm. But what I got to say is that when it comes to dealing with prosecuting state capture cases, I hoped that we would be further down the line, and we're actually far from where we would want to be. But I say state capture corruption cases, and we must not confuse that with other forms of corruption, which there are hundreds of cases in the courts in that regard.
Yeah, and there have been successful prosecutions in corruption cases as well, which we'll get to and talk about the issue of resources. I want us to be specific now about the state capture cases, because that's what, when I engage with listeners about the NPA, one of the things that they're unhappy about is that slowness or the lack of successful prosecution. What is going on? Why is the NPA failing to do the right work when it comes to the state capture cases? And I say failing because I'll use the two examples of Matsela Koko. The case is struck off the roll. The Nulani investment case where people are acquitted. And when you look at the judgments in the Matsela Koko, the judge says, practically you had not done all the work for the case to actually be brought to court. When you look at the Nulani case, the judge had some harsh words to say about the state's readiness for that case. So what do you think is the problem there? Because it looks to us like the NPA has bungled these cases.
So let me firstly say that it would really be sad if the success or failure of the NPA is calibrated through the lens of two cases. And let's throw in the Gupta extradition as well, because I'm sure you'll come to that. Mm. And that's sometimes also regarded as a failure of the NPA. There are, as I said, thousands of cases, 850,000 cases that the NPA, and I'll come to Nulane and Coco, mm. that the NPA staff are dealing with every year. 650,000 cases in court. In the SCCU alone, in 22-23, it achieved 329 convictions for serious and complex commercial crime cases. Mm-hmm. They have enrolled four cases relating the SCCU, I'm not talking about the ID, and I'll get to that, mm-hmm. Relating to 16 of Zondo Commission recommendations. So, and this is just in the past year, those 329 convictions for very high-profile matters. So, and lots of government officials, not at the highest levels, but at provincial level, some at national level, ex-ministers have been charged by the NPA. Before the courts already, we have some of the most senior CEOs, CFOs, companies involved in state capture, regiments. We have a number of directors of regiments, all before the courts. I agree those cases have not moved to finality. Mm. But getting to those matters that you mentioned, COCO and Nulane. Firstly, on the Nulane matter, the matter is on appeal. So, you know, we will await the outcome of that. But to say that the NPA has, in that matter, done a lot of very deep introspection and looking at what could we have done differently mm-hmm. as the NPA. Mm-hmm. It was the first reasonably, well, it was the first important state capture case, although not one of the biggest. And so we've had to have really, really careful and hard conversations with ourselves to try to understand what could we have done differently? How do we make sure that this doesn't happen again? Mm. Whilst we await the outcome of the appeal process.
Yeah.
On the COCO matter, as you're well aware, at the time of and before I move on to COCO, let me just explain that both these matters were dealt with by acting judges. Mm-hmm. Okay. And, you know, there are certain things as the prosecuting authority, we do not criticize the judiciary. We respect, we are officers of the court. And we have to respect the judgments and be very careful about our public pronouncements. But there have been concerns. And in the COCO matter, as you're well aware, the media actually exposed that the acting magistrate in that matter mm. had been doing business with Eskom. And we have the accused before him was COCO, who was working in Eskom at the time. And so that for us is a serious, serious conflict of interest. Mm. And it's not about a magistrate actually disclosing to the parties. It's about the magistrate reporting this matter to superiors and, in fact, deciding him or herself that there may be a perceived conflict, endorsing on the record of the proceedings a possible conflict and what the parties' views on this are. None of that was done. And so we are looking very, very carefully into what we will do, whether by way of review processes and reporting the conduct of the magistrate, and that process is you know, we're considering what the options are.
And that's a serious matter. And I think it's important that, I mean, as the NPA, you do make considerations around how to approach it. But when you look at the reasons why the judge struck the case off the roll, he says that the NPA indicated that they're still waiting for witness statements from the US and Germany and expert and forensic reports that are still incomplete. I mean, if that is the case, why then enroll the matter? Because you have to get your ducks in a row, make sure that the matter is ready for prosecution before you enroll it. Is that not the mistake the NPA makes in that, I mean, if you're still waiting for the statements, why are you taking the matter to court?
That is a very important consideration. And our view is the approach that we take in the NPA. You know, our policy requires us to enroll a matter when we have reasonable prospects of a successful prosecution. That is the standard. And so, particularly in high-profile cases like this, we want to ensure that we are almost trial-ready when we proceed to enroll these matters. In the COCO matter, there was a lot of additional evidence, data, you know, cell phone and computers and things that were seized after the arrest. Mm. And so in my view, the team didn't accurately assess how long it would take to actually get to procure the services to actually deal with the analysis of this data and to actually ensure that we were able to do that in a as fast as possible time. I think there was a lack of an understanding and a proper assessment of that. And the amount of data seized after the arrest also added to that challenge. And so we have looked internally in the NPA with regard to our procurement processes to make sure that we address this and it doesn't happen in the future. Mm. But one of the important aspects is that once the ID becomes permanent, and we're hoping that the bill will be on the president's desk very soon, once that happens, we are working with business as part of the presidential initiatives to provide the NPA with a state-of-the-art data forensics analytical capability, mm-hmm. which will be able to ensure that these kinds of challenges are thing of the past. So that will really be a game changer in terms of the NPA being able to move these cases quicker.
Do you think part of the reason is also some pressure from South Africans where prosecutors feel we need to be seen to be doing something? So that's why they would say go after COCO even when they know that there are certain documents that are still missing that need to be submitted that are part of the case that it's making against him. Because also the problem is then, I mean, the case that COCO makes is you have ruined my reputation and you open yourself to risk as the NPA if you don't tick all the boxes before you haul people before the courts and you open yourself to a risk of being challenged even by the people that you take to court. Do you think part of the reason is just the pressure on the prosecutors to be seen to be doing something and to be seen to be prosecuting these high-profile individuals?
So let me say that the NPA of today does not succumb to pressure from anywhere. And I mean anywhere, whether it's politicians, whether it's big business, or whether it's a media, or whether it's just the general public. Because if we do that, the risk of exactly what you are saying, the risk of us actually failing because we rushed with a case, is a risk that the NPA cannot afford to take. It has huge reputational issues attached to it. And so, therefore, we actually ensure that when we enroll cases, that we do have our ducks in our row. And also, you make a very important point, and we have stressed this, I have stressed this to prosecutors, to directors of public prosecutions, that our decisions have a huge impact on the lives of people. Mm. And we have to act responsibly, in line with our policies, in line with the evidence, because of that, and we cannot, you know, ruin people's lives because of mistakes that we make.
Yeah.
And so we are acutely aware of that. We also know that if we act under pressure, whether from the media or the people of this country, that's when we can make mistakes.
Mm.
And so we're very clear that we follow the evidence, we're guided by our policy, and we will only enroll cases when we meet the necessary standard for enrollment.
What internal reflections have you had with the team that was working on the Nulani case? I would imagine you've had difficult conversations with them because it was really embarrassing to hear the judge talk about a comedy of errors referring to the Nulani case. I mean, the judge said things like most of the documents that were presented in court were rejected because they were not originals and the state failed to authenticate the evidence. There were issues as well around some of the key witnesses. I think Shadrach Akezula, the judge said he was an evasive witness who at best admitted to contravening the PFMA, though he had been offered indemnity from Ford. And I think for me, what struck me the most from what the judge said was that the NPA was hoping that it's going to build evidence against the accused as it goes along. She wasn't satisfied that the NPA had a strong case. I mean, in a matter like this, where it looks like they're really, for lack of a better word, silly mistakes that are being made, what conversations have you had with the team, and what's their explanation? Was there no capacity, I mean, to do things like just providing statements that are originals? I mean, it's not difficult to authenticate statements and evidence.
So the first thing is that in a number of respects, we disagree with the decision, and that is why it's on appeal.
Mm, mm.
So I think it's important to note that. And given that is on appeal, as I said, we cannot, as a litigant, we cannot openly criticize, but we deal with the issues that we have a different view on in our papers.
Mm.
That's the first thing. The second thing is, you're right, the language of the acting judge in this matter, I don't know that I have in all my years of practice seen such strongly worded criticism.
Mm.
And we, sure, as the NPA prosecutors, we have lots of judgments where we are criticized. It's not unusual. You know, prosecutors, that will happen. We will win some cases, we lose some cases, we'll be criticized. But this particular one, I was myself really surprised at the language used by the acting judge in this matter. And it becomes very difficult for me to explain to the public and to you, Clement, because there are certain things that as the prosecuting authority, we cannot say in public. And so, and that actually constrains me as the national director, because I want to take the public into confidence. I want to explain to you, look, there were other issues that we have concerns about, but I can't speak about it in public. And that makes it difficult, because accused persons can, you know, speak freely and, you know, about things. And we can't even respond when we know we have good reasons for why certain things have happened. That said, we have looked at the conduct of the prosecutors in this matter. We've got senior, the head of the ID, Andrea Johnson, got senior prosecutors to look at this. I got an advisor in my office to interrogate the judgment, to look at the conduct of the prosecutors.
Mm.
And we are dealing with those issues because we cannot have this happening ever again. This has had a devastating impact on the reputation of the NPA. But it's on appeal, and let's await the outcome.
I suppose what's also concerning is that the extradition of the Guptas is dependent on getting this case right. So if you mess up this case, what hope is there then for us to see the successful extradition of the Guptas?
So, look, the original extradition request regarding the Guptas dealt with two cases, Estina and this one. These are not going to be the only two cases that any future extradition request will deal with. And the ID is working very, very hard on ensuring that other cases are also ready to be included in any future extradition request.
Mm.
In addition to us, you know, recruiting very high-level Zondo resources to assist in this process. So these will definitely not be the two matters in any future extradition request.
Okay. Before we get to the headlines, what message do you have for South Africans who are desperate to see accountability for state capture? And I hear what you say in that don't judge us based on these two cases and think the NPA is failing to do its work based on these two cases. But what do you say to South Africans who are not inspired by the outcomes of these two crucial cases, because these are some of the first cases of state capture, and they were hoping we are now going to see these high-profile people being behind bars? What do you say to those who are losing hope and saying, if you couldn't get things right with these first two, what hope is there that we are going to see those that were responsible and took part in the state capture project being held accountable?
What I can say to South Africans, one is that as a citizen of this country, me as the national director, I came back to this country after 10 years, almost 10 years in the Netherlands, in order to play my part in ensuring that these looters and thieves of our country are held to account and that they are prosecuted and that at the end of the day, those found guilty receive the appropriate sanctions. That's the first thing. The second thing I want to say to South Africans is that these two matters, I've explained to South Africans what happened in these two matters. You only have to look at the thousands of successful cases, not as high profile, but really important cases that the NPA is prosecuting every day. That should give you a level of confidence that we can do this. But that these two cases, one is an appeal, one, you, Coco, you understand the challenges. Once we have a permanent ID, which I'm hoping will happen soon, as I said to you, once we get the capacity and capabilities, the ID at the moment has about 12 to 15 investigators with criminal investigative powers that have been seconded from the DPCI. Mm. With the number of cases that the ID has, it's quite amazing that they have in fact enrolled 37 matters, that they have declared 103 investigators, that there are 208 accused persons as of January 2024 that are before the courts in ID related cases. When you look at the weak legal framework, the serious challenges with the resources that we've been having, and I can spend days speaking to you, Clement, about all kinds of challenges. We are certainly hoping that once this bill becomes parliament and the ID can recruit investigators with criminal investigative powers, as well as with all of the forensic capabilities that business will support the ID with, that these will be game changers. But I also want to caution, because once the bill goes through parliament, South Africans are again going to think cases are going to come through very quickly. But we need recruitment processes, in as much as working with the Department of Justice, we are trying to fast track the recruitment processes. Mm-hmm. But we work within government and there are certain prescripts that we have to comply with. But I also want to make another point that the Zondo Commission was like a double-edged sword. It was it's hugely important for the country. But also, it didn't give the NPA a blueprint for prosecutions or cases that were ready for prosecutions. Mm. And for South Africans to understand that to testify before the commission, you're able to lead hearsay evidence, the admissibility rules in a criminal case do not apply. Mm. And so when we need to put together a solid a case that meets the criminal standard, it's very different from what you can say in a commission.
But you're not starting from scratch. At least you've got some stuff. Come out of the commission.
Absolutely. We're not starting from scratch. But understand, sometimes people who testify in a commission, they're not cross-examined in a commission.
Yeah.
They may not be such willing witnesses. So we're dealing with lots of challenges.
Yeah.
But you're right.
And we'll continue with the chat after the latest in eyewitness news headlines. I'd like us to also talk more about the issue of capacity constraints and how the head of the NPA has tried to ensure also that there's just sufficient funding for this organization to do its work. Because all of us need an NPA that works. We need an NPA that has enough resources, that is able to go after these thieves, especially, and also those that are in these high-profile positions. It's just after 10:30.
7:02. The Clement Manyathela Show. Let's walk the talk.
It's 24 minutes before 11 o'clock. We're in conversation this morning with the head of the NPA, Advocate Shamila Batohi. And I have got questions coming from you. You can give us a call on 011-883-0702. The WhatsApp line is 072-702-1702. I'll start with this one, Advocate Batohi, from Chief Justice Majola on Twitter, who's asking, Clement, please can you ask the NPA, they need to reinstate the graduate recruitment programs. Talent must flow. Do you still have this kind of a recruitment program?
We still have it, but it's been suspended.
Mm.
And that was due to budget cuts. and the judge makes a very important point. We are hoping that we'd still, you know, that in the next year, certainly this year, we don't have it this year, but that we will be able to restart it next year. There's a lot of support for it. It's very important. But currently, with the budget constraints, we are not able to.
So how are you then functioning with the budget constraints?
Well, let me say that, firstly, the executive, the minister, has been extremely supportive of the NPA, also the Minister of Finance. So it's not just about money. It is also about those specialized skills, very expensive specialized skills that we need to procure from outside of the NPA. But with regard to the money itself, let's say we did get cuts, not as bad as other government departments, but it is certainly needing us to be very careful about how we spend. But the ID budget has been ring-fenced, and we are certainly hoping that we'll be able to procure those high-level skills that we need. One of the challenges of building those skills internally is that we often build these skills and then they leave to the private sector. The NPA becomes a feeding ground for people because we can't match salaries.
Yeah.
And it's a sort of a vicious cycle. We train people, we get them really to a state where they can do the work, and the private sector comes in and offers them salaries that we can't match. So there are serious challenges, and that's why the private sector and, you know, other government departments that can offer better salaries. Our people leave to the SIU, for example. We have financial investigators that have left to the SIU because they have a better salary dispensation.
Mm-hmm.
So the government's very, very supportive in trying to give the NPA the money it needs.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, it's not just a money issue, it's about a skills issue and trying to get those critical skills, expensive skills, into the NPA. And that is why our partnerships with business are so important.
Let's talk about those partnerships with business. How are they structured? Because I do remember that there were some people who were concerned about businesses somehow having a direct link, you know, with their assistance on the NPA. How are they structured to insulate the NPA from any risk that it may be exposed to?
That's an important question. And whether it's real or perceived risk, it's something we need to deal with. And so, firstly, the creation of this digital forensic data analytical capability that I talked about from business is part of the president's initiative with business to support government in three areas: Eskom, logistics and transport, and crime and corruption. So it falls under the presidential initiative, and there are safeguards built in there. But we also have an MOU with BLSA. And so we do not work directly with individual businesses. And so any support to NPA comes through our MOU with business leadership, and we do not work directly with business. And the other thing is, we do not receive any cash money from business. It is skills and support that comes through our MOU with BLSA, and also the key one that I mentioned is through the presidential initiative that has safeguards built in.
You mentioned some of the staff members leaving to the SIU, which has really been doing an incredible work with following the money at the National Lotteries Commission, and they've been able to attach some property. And the question many of us have been asking ourselves, if the NPA has, I mean, the SIU has been able to go that far in following the money and attaching properties and even bringing back the money that's been stolen through the National Lotteries Commission, why are people then not being prosecuted? Are you communicating with the SIU or with the Hawks? How does the system work, and what does the law say? So once the SIU has done that work, at what point do you come in as the NPA?
So let me firstly say that the mandate of the SIU is basically to, in a nutshell, deal with civil recoveries. They are not a criminal investigative unit. The criminal investigations are done by the DPCI. But the SIU plays a hugely important role in terms of looking at fraudulent contracts in government primarily. And so it is also the SIU mandate to actually look at, you know, civilly dealing with damages relating to those contracts. The SIU does not have powers to actually seize and attach properties and money. Those are powers that the NPA, the National Director, has in terms of the Prevention of Organized Crime Act. Mm. But we work very, so all of the lotteries, the work done by the SIU is hugely important to meet the standard of required in what is referred to as Chapter 6 asset forfeiture. That means it's not conviction based. You actually need to prove on a balance of probabilities, not the criminal standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, that these, whether it's money or, you know, properties, these mm-hmm. assets are proceeds of crime. And so we have actually, we worked with the SIU. So all of these freezing orders, etc., is the SIU working with the asset forfeiture unit in the lotteries case. We work collaboratively with the SIU to ensure that all of these orders are brought based on evidence that the SIU gathers yeah. that meets the civil standard. So the thing is, once the SIU completes their civil investigations, if in terms of the act there's any evidence of pointing towards criminality, they must then refer the matter to the NPA. And that is a challenge in the framework, because the NPA does not investigate, except for the ID, which has limited criminal investigative powers. Normally, these cases have to go to the DPCI to ensure that they investigate it to the required criminal standard, and then the prosecutors deal with the matter in order to make decisions to prosecute. So it's clear, you must understand that the standard and the function of the SIU is very different in terms of the criminal standard of prosecutions. But the work they do is very important in terms of giving the investigative agencies, whether yeah. it's the ID or the DPCI, the sort of groundwork and the pointers towards where evidence
yeah.
could be that will help us reach that standard.
From what the SIU has referred to the NPA so far, are you satisfied that there are some cases that you can follow up where there's strong evidence that meets the test for the NPA then to go, we can go for prosecution here?
There hasn't been a single case from the SIU that meets that standard, right? Because as I say, it's a criminal investigative, sorry, they are civil investigative capacity. So we then have to either, if it's a state capture related matter that falls in the ID mandate, those cases go into the ID for them to investigate the criminal aspect yeah. and make mm. sure we reach the standard. Or the majority of them up to now have actually been going to the DPCI, where they have their own challenges with capacities and with capture and, you know, whether it's corruption even amongst our ranks. And so those have to then be investigated, and then the prosecutors take a decision.
Then we can follow up from
exactly.
that.
Exactly. But okay. we are working with Advocate Mutibi. It's very complex, and sadly, you know, there's not enough time to properly explain it to the people of this country. But it's important that they understand these differences, so that, and the mandates of the different authorities, so that they know what flows from one entity to the yeah. next. What are the standards of proof? Mm-hmm. What are the, you know, and so
in a nutshell, the SIU, even when we are told, okay, this is the investigation we've done, they can't just refer those matters to you. That matter must still be investigated by the Hawks before it can come back to you, unless it is, of course, state capture related, because the ID can take over it.
You're right, but for one yeah. thing, an important issue, the SIU Act requires that everything they investigate gets referred to the NPA.
But the NPA doesn't have investigative.
That's the problem. That's the challenge. And we've been working with Advocate Mutibi, you know, yeah. because to say, you know, I think, you know, there might be some I've got to be careful what I say here in terms of, you know, merit in the SIU, you know, having some kind of ability to get those cases to the criminal standard and refer it to the NPA, you know, for decisions to prosecute. Mm-hmm. But as it currently is, it's the SIU, the law says you must send it to the NPA, but the NPA doesn't have the investigative capacity, but for the ID. So most of the matters up until now have been going to the DPCI, and then it comes back to us for decisions.
All right, let's go to the WhatsApp voice notes coming through. I'm going to ask you, Advocate Batoye, to please put on the headphones so that you can hear the voice notes. They're coming through on 072-702-1702.
Good day, Clement, and good day to your guest. Clement, please ask your guest why the NPA is always struggling to prosecute commercial cases. On many occasions, those commercial cases end up being withdrawn on technical teas. Is that a lack of capacity or a lack of capabilities, or both? Thanks, David.
Hey, good morning, Clement, to the director of public prosecution. Look, when I hear she talks a lot about budget constraints, which it would seem is a reality in that space. And I've heard the minister saying this, whether they were willing to accept or they've already accepted donations from private companies. Does she think it's a good idea to accept funds from someone who could potentially come back to be subject of an investigation, you know? I mean, a private company could, for all intents and purposes, be under scrutiny by the NPA. Will they act partially or impartially in that sense? So does she think private donors for any institution such as the NPA is a good one? And if so, why? Because in my view, it throws a whole lot of things out there.
Yeah, you had already started responding to the second one about not receiving money from business. Maybe you can just reemphasize that for those that missed it. And then the first question about capacity to prosecute financial crimes. I'm thinking of Steinhoff now and whether there's actually capacity to deal with a complex case like the Steinhoff fraud case.
So, yes, I did speak about the budget constraints. To be very clear, we do not accept money from private businesses. So I did explain earlier how it's structured to ensure that the independence of the NPA is protected. So we fiercely guard our independence. And so it's important that even perceptions that the NPA could be, acting in favor of certain businesses is an important issue that we need to actually deal with. So we do not accept any funding, and they are safeguards to ensure the, as I explained earlier, on Steinhoff matter, and to basically, maybe I'll deal with both the first question and Steinhoff. Let me firstly say that before I took office, the sad reality is the Specialized Commercial Crime Unit in the NPA, which is the specialist unit that was meant to be dealing with high profile, complex corruption and other commercial crimes, was in fact not dealing with them. And that's for obvious reasons. There was no political will or will in the NPA to deal with those complex state capture matters. And so there were very few trials that were actually being conducted in the SCCU. There were pleas and so it did erode the skills and expertise that I talked about. But to say that we have worked really hard in building that capacity in the past 5 years. And as I explained earlier, the number of convictions just in the past year relating to serious and complex commercial crime matters is 329 in the 2023-24 period. And so about the high number of withdrawals, I'm not sure, I don't have the stats yet, but we carefully monitor the withdrawal figures. And, whether it's in this field, whether it's in sexual and gender-based violence matters, and if it is higher than we think it should be, we look into what are the challenges here. But I want to really assure the people of South Africa that we are, trying to capacitate the prosecutors internally and get the skills that we need, externally if possible. But on the Steinhoff matters, you say that, this case was investigated by highly skilled prosecutors for 6 years. And prosecutors in the NPA that were working on a very, very complex case spanning different jurisdictions, etc. And so, so we do have some prosecutors that are really skilled and that work really hard. And in the Steinhoff matter, in the face of, very hurtful criticism in the public at times that the NPA was doing nothing. But 6 years later, we were able to bring a case to court, understanding that Germany brought a case 1 year before us, which was 5 years, and which is a much better resourced country. So I think, you know, the prosecutors did really well, considering the complexities in Steinhoff, to be able to bring a case within 6 years.
Yeah.
And that is in line with international ballpark. Even if you look at the Serious Fraud Office in the UK, that's actually, sadly, this is how long it takes for complex matters to come to court.
I've got a message from someone here who's just reflecting on their time at the NPA, who says, good morning, Clement and the advocate. I'm a former member of the Directorate of Special Operations, and I left the NPA before some political leaders disbanded our unit due to our successes. Heads off to all those that are still trying to fight crime and injustice in the decaying landscape. So kudos to the work that they're doing. That's a message there from Anonymous, who says they used to work for the Directorate of Directorate of Specialized Operations. I wanted to ask about the TRC cases, Advocate Ntsebeza has recommended that there must be a commission of inquiry to investigate why these cases have stalled. What's the next step after that?
So let me say that, you know, since I took office, we have worked very hard with the DPCI to create a dedicated capacity to deal with TRC matters. So we have 15 dedicated TRC prosecutors across the country, and the DPCI has a number of investigators. I have that figure somewhere. I'll try to get that. But working with, there are 34 dedicated TRC investigators. And so working with the DPCI, we are seized currently with 137 matters under investigations. And, you know, in the past 3 years since we created this capacity, there have been a number of cases, inquests that have been reopened, inquest of Dr. Agate, Mr. Ernest Dipale, Dr. Hafaji, Mr. Haroon, number of inquests that are set to commence in 2024. And these inquests relate to, for example, the Craddock 4, relating to the deceased Kalata, Koniwe, Mshlauli, and Mkonto, relating to the Highgate Hotel deaths, which was in 1993 in East London, where, you know, patrons were shot and, you know, no inquest was held. Looking at the North Crest 5, where in 1993, five teenagers, including two 12-year-olds, were shot by members of the South African Defence Force because they believed that the home was storing arms. We have several of these inquests that are going to be opened in this year, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
But working really hard with the DPCI on these matters, there was a conviction in November last year of Mr. Madonsela, who was sentenced to 10 years direct imprisonment for the murder of 17-year-old UDF activist Mr. Sipilele Nxumalo. And so there's number of cases that are coming through now.
Yeah.
And a lot of work happening. But with regard to the commission, setting up of commission of inquiry, that is a decision that the executive takes.
Mm-hmm.
And so currently we are satisfied. And in fact, Advocate Ntsebeze expressed a view that the NPA was largely complying with the decision in the Rodriguez matter in terms of setting up this capacity to deal with these matters.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of work. But on the commission, you know, it is an executive decision.
Decide.
The minister and the president have
from what you've seen, that, does it make sense that decades later we have still seen not enough successful prosecutions from the TRC cases?
Well, of course, I think it's an absolute travesty of justice that people that were responsible for atrocities committed during apartheid era have not been held to account. Of course, we had the TRC process where a number of people were granted amnesty, but a number of them were either not granted amnesty or did not apply.
Mm.
And so, sadly, for various reasons over the years, you know, I don't want to go into detail, but Advocate Vusi Pikoli, my predecessor, has actually, you know, he said there was
political interference.
He's deposed to an affidavit, and there are former NPA members that have also deposed to affidavits, saying that, you know, there was interference. And so, you know, I think that it's hugely problematic. It has not, the families have not seen justice. And so we are really trying to do what we can now in a fiscally constrained environment where the country is really wanting only seeing people for corruption in orange overalls. There's all of this really important work that the NPA has to focus on to ensure we bring justice for the families of those who passed away or other atrocities during apartheid.
Yeah, we're out of time, but I wanted to ask about your term as the NDPP. In my recollection, I could be wrong. I haven't seen anyone who's finished a 10-year term. Are you going to?
Well, let me say I have every intention of finishing the legally permissible term. And I am, because it's, let me put it this way, it's 10 years or 65, whichever comes sooner.
Yeah.
But I am certainly
10 years or 65.
Intent on completing that period. And,
okay.
And before we round up, we haven't talked about asset forfeiture, but criminal, you know, accountability for corruption and other, whether it's organized crime, you know, there's a lot of money laundering, there's FATF, you know, we need to make sure the country gets out of the grey listing. We really have a very bold asset forfeiture strategy, and under Advocate Rabaji Rastaba, you know, really looking at civil forfeiture where, like in the lotteries matter, we work with other in law enforcement and the DPCI, the ID, the SIU, to try to ensure that we actually take away, bring back the stolen money, because our country needs it.
Absolutely.
So that's part of the accountability as well.
Advocate Shamila Batohi, I appreciate you making time for us this morning.
Thank you very much.